Days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. We are Willowbrook Christian Church, and next Sunday we're going to celebrate the day we were born. The last Sunday of October 1999, that was a big day in our congregation's life. Today, the Sunday before that, I would like to think about why. Why did we build this building? Why did we move in? Why have we met together every week since? What are we here for? What should we be doing? What in the world are we doing here? To answer that today, let me point to a chapter in the Bible, one of the most famous chapters, one of the best chapters in the whole Bible. It starts out, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" I love this. Jesus was having lunch with people who were not religious, and the church people of his day thought that that was disgusting. And you know, they're not wrong. There's something to be said for how they think, because, you know, birds of a feather flock together, and one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. And when you play in the glove with white, when you play in the mud with white gloves on, the gloves get muddy and the mud never gets glovy. The religious people thought that the not religious people were muddy. They were spoiled. They were wrong. They were not religious. Like the woman at the well who had been married to five different guys, and she was now sleeping with a sixth. Like Zacchaeus, who was a little thief. Like the adulterous woman who was caught in the act of adultery. And the religious people could not understand why anyone who was right would hang out with all these people who are wrong. So when Jesus is eating pizza with the tax collectors and the sinners and laughing and having fun, they spit in his general direction. But instead of spitting back, Jesus told the religious people a story about a minimum wage worker. Jesus said, "Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and he loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and his neighbors together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep.'" Jesus said, "I tell you, in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous people who do not need to repent." So do you remember last week when I mentioned that my daughter leaves me alone sometimes with her dog? And all of you came running up afterwards and said, "That's not true, is it?" Hey, when I make stuff up, I will tell you that I made stuff up. And that story was not made up. Sometimes, rarely, but occasionally, Nova and I have ended up in the same house alone together. And the only thing that I worry about when Carice leaves Nova with me is that I'm not going to lose her. I know a preacher who was watching his wife's dog once, and the dog ran away, right out the door. He was just looking out the door to see something. The dog took off, ran down the road, and the preacher said, "Doggone." Not really, I just made that up. But the dog did run off. And the preacher and his wife and their kids searched the neighborhood all Saturday night into early Sunday morning, before they finally found the dog just before it was time to preach that Sunday. And he said he preached that morning with much rejoicing. But I know how traumatic that all was for them, and I'm so afraid it's going to happen to me. And that is why I don't, mostly ever, volunteer to take care of my daughter's dog. Shepherds took care of sheep, and sometimes a sheep would run away. Happens. And shepherds, kind of weird, shepherds develop a love for their sheep. So in Jesus' story, the shepherd went out searching to find the runaway because that sheep mattered to him. And when he found it, he was happier over the one that he found than the 99 that hadn't gone anywhere. Like heaven is when one not religious person chooses to be part of God's family again. Happy. Jesus is trying to help the religious people see what on earth he's doing. Jesus is trying to help the religious people see what on earth they're supposed to be doing. But he can tell by their expressions on their face that they're not getting it yet. Enter story two, stage right. The second story Jesus tells goes like this. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and she loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and her neighbors together and she says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." Jesus said, "In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Have you ever lost a silver coin? Big deal, it's a nickel, it's a quarter, right? So what? But have you ever lost a silver coin that comes in the shape of a key? Like your car keys? Oh yeah, then you sweep the house, carefully searching until you find it, right? I've heard preachers say this story about the woman losing the coin. Preachers say this story shows us that something can be lost right in the house. They think Jesus is referring to people who are in the house, in church buildings all the time, but are still lost. They're lost, like the coin, when they're right inside the house. And that situation can happen, but I think some preachers are trying way too hard. I think what Jesus is talking about here is a lady who lost a hefty chunk of change, and she panicked until she found it, and then she was really, really happy. Like, if you got a refund check from the government for taxes that you overpaid in the amount of, like, $11,000, that's good, right? Unless you lost it, which would be really not good. Unless you found it again, which would then be really, really good. And that, says Jesus, is how heaven's residents feel when one lost person changes his mind, when one lost person changes her mind. Which is why Jesus says, "I'm here to seek and to save lost people." Do you get it? That's why I was born. That's why we're all born, Jesus said, to be on God's search and rescue team. Do you get it? And he looked at the religious people in front of them, and clearly from the expressions on their face, they did not get it. Did you hear about the blind man who walks into a bar, and then a table, and then a chair? Yeah, the people who were considered religious sitting in front of Jesus, they cannot see at all what Jesus is talking about. So he goes for story number 3, about a dad who lost his younger son and his older one too. The story goes like this. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had 2 sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, I wish you were dead so that I could have my inheritance. But since you're not, how about give me my share of the estate?' So the father divided his property between the sons. Not long after that," Jesus says, "the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living." Wild living, and he had lots, like $2,000 a night hotel rooms, like champagne, like he bought fancy Dijon ketchups. He was hanging out in swanky bars. Someone told me this. Do you know that before the invention of crowbars, crows had to drink at home? The younger brother was hanging out at bars. He was living high on the hog, so to speak. Not literally, of course, but he was really enjoying his life. Verse 14 says, "After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need." For some people, the only thing that will ever get their attention is if they hit rock bottom. But some people hit rock bottom and start digging. Like this guy, when he ran out of money. "So he went," Jesus says, "and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, this boy, this young son, said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Could you make me one of your hired servants?'" I think this is one of the best lines in the whole Bible. I think one of the best lines in the whole Bible is, "When he came to his senses." So often people choose to live crazy lives. They just make ridiculously bad decisions. Anyone in their right mind standing around can see that what those people are choosing will not work for a million years. But somehow these people who are making these choices think that somehow it's going to somehow work for them. And then something happens, and they suddenly come to their senses. all of a sudden, they get it. And the first thing that a person says when they really have a come to their senses moment, almost always the same, they almost always say, "What in the world was I thinking?" They always say, "I can't believe I was so stupid." When they really get it, they always say, "I can never be forgiven for that, but I need to at least go apologize." Verse 20 says, "So he got up, the son got up, and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." Like the father in the story who was looking for his son to return, hoping that he would come back someday, God is constantly trying to get every person on earth to come back home. That's all God thinks about. That's all he plans for every day. That's all he keeps trying to make work. The Reuben Donnelly Company was at one time our country's number one company for printing magazines. Reuben Donnelly, they made magazines. And due to a glitch in their system, they sent one rancher in Powder Bluff, Colorado, 9,734 notices in the mail that his subscription to National Geographic had expired. He got 9,734 notices in the mail, at which point he sent money in and wrote, "Send me the magazine, I give up." That's how God deals with us. He keeps sending message after message after message to us to please come back to him. And here's where the story number three is a lot like the first two Jesus told. In the end, it went like this. Something was lost, something was found, a party ensued. Jesus is trying to help these religious people. He's trying to help them see God's heart by telling them stories and relating to them what our Father in heaven is like. So stories go like this. Sheep lost, sheep found, party. Coin lost, coin found, party. Son lost, son found, party. The shepherd couldn't have been happier. The lady couldn't have been happier. The father couldn't have been happier. Like our Father in heaven, Jesus says, when one person comes back to him, Jesus says, when one person comes to his senses, comes to her senses, when one person repents, God could not be happier. Get it? The people he's telling the story to don't get it. So Jesus adds one more scene in verse 22. Jesus continues the story. "But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older brother was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard the music and the dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him." The older brother does not like the script of lost, found, party. The older brother thinks it would be better if it went like this: lost, show up again, slam the door in his face. He did not think the younger brother deserved to be part of their family anymore because of what he'd done. He did not want the younger brother to be part of the family anymore because of all that stuff. Did you hear about the husband whose wife kept telling him to stop acting like a flamingo? And the husband said finally he just had to put his foot down. The older brother thought the younger brother was wrong. He had chosen poorly. He deserved to suffer. And when he came back, the older brother thought, we should say, beat off, beat it. So he refused to go inside. He refused to party. He refused to be happy with everybody else. And his father came out and pleaded with the older son to please come in because the brother had been lost and now he's found. The end. That's the end of Jesus' story. And we are left to wonder, did the older brother ever go in? Did he eventually welcome his brother back? Or did he stay outside mad, unable to forgive, unwilling to love? The Prodigal Son story is kind of the original choose-your-own-adventure story. Because mostly when we hear about the Prodigal Son story, we cheer for the boy who returns. Yay, we can come back, no matter how bad we've been. Or we stand amazed at the father who welcomed the boy back. He ran to him. Fathers never ran in that culture, but he was so glad he ran to the boy. But really, Jesus tells this whole story so that we'll think about the last thing. Jesus wants us to think, are we at all like the older brother? Are we at all like the religious people Jesus is talking to who just don't get it? Because God's really into lost things being found. And the question Jesus wants us to ask is, are we at all? We have spent the last month as a church thinking about how to live our lives on mission, how to live life so that people will see our good deeds and glorify our Father in heaven by connecting with them and serving with them and speaking to them, by growing, by praying for them. But I think before any of that, that's all good. We need to do those things. That needs to be who we are in our DNA. But before any of that, or maybe through all of that, we need to decide something. Are the people that we're surrounded by every day, all day long, are they lost or are they wrong? Because that makes all the difference in the world in how we treat them. When people are lost, when you meet someone who's lost, what's your first response? When someone comes up to you and says, could you help me? I don't know where I am. How do you respond to that? We're all like, sure, I can tell you where you are. Let me tell you where you're trying to go. You feel sorry for the person. You feel empowered if you know how to help them get to where they want to be. You feel generous because you're suddenly in a position where you're able to help somebody. I was at the hospital waiting room with Ray this week. Gina was being taken up to her room. We were told that we could go see her. We just needed to go up the red elevators, and Ray started walking down one hall. I said, wait, Ray, the red elevator's this way. And he said, no, they told me this way. I said, no, they're right here. Come this way. So we walked down the hall, and we turned, and we walked down another hall, and we ended up right where they told Ray to go in the first place. But that was where the red elevators were, and we got there. Not much of a story, but I liked the fact that I knew how to get around Rochester General Hospital. Mike Bowers was in town for a camp meeting yesterday. He's a preacher from the Clarence Church, and he was in town for a meeting, and he wanted to go visit my dad afterwards. And I said, well, Mike, I'm going to go down and see Dad now, too. You want to follow me? And I led Mike down. I had to pull over once because he got caught at a light, and I didn't want to leave him in hang, so I just pulled over and waited till a couple cars went by. Then Mike came. I was happy to do it. It's not much of a story, but I was very happy that I got him there. Rustin Paving was here a while back, paving our new parking lot. I was here to make sure that the pickleball court went in the right place. It was measured correctly, and just here to make sure, oversee how the thing. I was sitting in the building. A guy came into the building. He said, where's your bathroom? And I said, oh, down the hall, third door on the right. Not much of a story, but meant a lot to him, I think. When somebody is lost, we naturally want to help them, right? It's just how we're made. But when somebody's wrong, that's different. When somebody's wrong, we feel a need to correct them. When somebody's wrong, we feel like we need to fix them to see it our way by force if necessary. When people are wrong, that means they're not quite as good as we are because we're right. They're somehow less than we are. I mean, they're wrong. Democrats look at Republicans and think, you're wrong. Republicans look at Democrats and think, you're wrong about us being wrong. Evolutionists look at creationists and think, you're wrong. Creationists look back and think, no, we're not. Mets fans look at Yankee fans and think, you're wrong. Everyone looks at Patriots fans and says, how could you? Really? I mean, what in the world? Most everyone thinks, what are you thinking? Dog lovers look at cat lovers and think, you're wrong. Cat lovers look at dog lovers and think, you're wrong. I look at both of them and say, ugh. There's something about thinking that you're right and somebody else is wrong that turns it into something adversarial. Like, I need to make you right. I need to show you how you're messed up. I need to straighten you out. Like, I am somehow superior to you because I'm right and you're wrong. Some old guys were sitting around in the locker rooms talking about underwear. One elderly gent asked another elderly gent, boxers or briefs? And the other guy said, depends. And our attitude towards the people around us depends a lot on how we see them. If they're wrong, then that would mean that we're right and we need to show them how right we really are and how wrong they are. But if they're lost, then we just need to help them on their way. And one of those is way more likely to be well received from their point of view. Peter says, but in your heart, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. Peter says we're supposed to do this with gentleness and respect. To me, that sounds like helping somebody who's lost, not arguing with someone who's wrong. And trying to help people find their way is such a better way to go. A story about Rachel Harlow. She spent five works. It's a hard to tell story. She spent 5 months working with a campus ministry in England. During that time, while she was in England, she developed a friendship with one of the students there who was an avowed atheist. His name was Ash. He was brilliant. He's very good at shooting down Christians who tried to argue with him. He was just so smart, and he was so practiced. But he liked Rachel and her group of Christian friends who would just sit with him in the pub and talk about stuff. When Rachel was done with her time in England, she came back to the States. She stayed in contact with Ash, and slowly, eventually, Ash decided that maybe Christianity had something that he might need in life. And when he decided that, he wrote this to Rachel. He said, when I first met you, I could have given you hours of justification for why I hated religion. I could have reeled off a list and put you as a religious fanatic in your place. Had you come at me and challenged why I hated religion, I would have told you why I pitied people who believed in God and Jesus and the resurrection. And no offense, I probably would have come away looking pretty good for all my excellent arguments and rational victories of logic. He said, but you didn't do that. You just went ahead and showed me that most of what I called facts were opinions, and that my justifications were all BS. He didn't write BS, but I just... You know. He said, it's kind of like I spent years building all these foundations to stand on. And people would come along and they'd say, hey, your foundations are looking pretty rubbish there. And I'd throw stuff at them and tell them to bugger off. They were, after all, just standing in the mud. But then you showed up, Rachel. And you walked up. And instead of poking fun at my rubbish foundations, you just walked over and stood on a rock. And I'm looking over thinking, hang on, she's not saying it, but that rock required no building at all. And it looks sturdier than my foundations. And you haven't got to tell me anything, because I can see your damn rock. No arguments, no fighting, no I'm right and you're wrong. Just standing there on a rock, willing to point somebody in a new direction. Ash eventually became a Christian and married Rachel. My dad used to say, people who do not follow Jesus are not our enemies. They are victims of the enemy. And they are the precious ground we're fighting for. Lost or wrong? Did you hear about the English teacher who was trapped inside a haunted house one night? And she walked into a room and she saw a dead body on the floor. And written on the wall in blood were these words. So she dipped her finger in the blood and she went over and underneath on the wall she wrote, folks, we can be so worried about being right that we're wrong. The best part of life is helping people who are lost find their way home. And that's the attitude our church has to have. That's our job. Jesus said in Luke 19, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." To find the lost and to rescue them, to point people who cannot find their way to the one who is the way. That's why we're born, to be part of God's big plan, which goes like this: lost, found, party. Let's pray.